Welcome to Things I Wish I Knew, the podcast from Thinking Faith, a work of the Jesuits in Britain. I'm Julia, I'm in my early 30s, and I'm living in a Jesuit young adult community. So we all live hectic lives and often don't get time to reflect on what's happening both to us and around us. This podcast is meant to help you to take a moment to stop and think about where you are, where you're going, and where your relationship with God fits into it all. Every week I meet a new guest who tells me about something they've experienced which changed their life forever. And by talking about the things they'd wish they'd known at the time, we'll explore the idea that God is in all things, and we'll talk about that part that faith plays in navigating life's challenges. So today I'm speaking to Harry. Harry is 36-year-old. And he's discerning religious life in a monastery. He spent the last year living with the Jesuits after recently being received into the Catholic Church. He was also at the time teaching in a secondary school. Harry talks about in his episode about how he was working in Brussels in the EU Parliament and then as a journalist. And so this episode, he's so open with his journey and how God was with him along the way, even when he didn't know God. So Harry, who were you when you were an atheist?
Who was I when I was an atheist? I think, first of all, when people say they describe themselves as an atheist, there's a difference between most people who I think they've just absorbed the culture around them and they would say default, I'm an atheist, not because they've ever really thought about it. That's just where our culture's got to. In the same way, presumably, 60, 70 years ago, most people have said, I'm a Christian, not because they'd really thought about it, but because the culture was Christian. My mother is a Catholic. She was raised Catholic, went to convent school, and then she had a pretty dreadful experience of the nuns, as the nuns going at her, which sounds quite a common thing for that generation, actually, like pre-Vatican Council, the culture of the religious orders at that time. Anyway, so she took a big step back from the church. It took me to Mass until I was about 10, and then that was it. So I had no formal religious education, and just, I think, where most people are at the moment in this country, at least. Father, not religious at all. And then the other part of it is that when I got to university, it was right at the peak of the new atheists. So Richard Dawkins, who was actually a tutor in the college I was at New College in Oxford. So it was peak Richard Dawkins. And so we all kind of rocked up and we just absorbed the culture, which is that religion is for stupid people. God is either made up or an oppressive fanatic. The Christians I knew at university, I judged them. I really judged them.
Did you think they were weirdos?
Yes, I did. And they were always smiling. they were just nice people. You're saying that as though you've got experience of that perspective.
No, I was just thinking that that is often the misconception of Christians.
Yeah.
That they are seen as people who are weird because they've got this belief in God. And in a world where you don't believe in God, that's a weird thing to believe.
Which I'm sure, if you were to go back 100 years and you would have been like, someone say they're an atheist, you'd be like, what, are you okay? Like, so it's, I think it really is wherever the culture's at, you're weird in relation to that culture. I mean, I went through a neo-pagan Buddhist phase. Well, we'll come to that in a moment. But most of my friends are, I call them, this is what I joke, you know, it's like pick and mix spirituality, do a bit of chakra work, get some crystals, go on like a retreat or whatever, which is great. Like what that, you know, that's that helped me when it helped me. But I kind of say to them now, I'm like, there's nothing more countercultural and radical than being a Catholic because it's so shocking to people. Because of all of these preconceptions about, first of all, what the word God means, who Christ was, what the church is, what the church is not, you know, all of these kind of beliefs that we've absorbed, or that the culture has absorbed, the idea that the Bible is made up, that Christ didn't really exist. All of these are questions I had to work through myself.
So back when you were an atheist, how did you feel about the Catholic Church?
It didn't even figure in my life. I just, so far away. I'm smiling because I'm now in a monastery. It was just such a distant, irrelevant thing. And also scary, judgmental, representing everything we'd escaped from. You know, I really bought into this progress myth that humanity is on this wonderful journey to these sunny uplands where all suffering will be eliminated and technological solutions of everything, and that we are cleverer now than people were 100 years ago, 500 years ago, 2000 years ago. And so the Catholic Church just represented all of that stuff. The Catholic Church was this like very weird thing.
So you've gone from this, the Catholic Church was this really weird thing, to now living in a monastery where you've sold nearly every belonging you have.
I have. I followed the Lord's commands, Julia.
Including your sofa that I know you're...
Oh, don't talk about the sofa.
So sad about. How did that come about?
Oh, goodness me. I'm very conscious that at the moment, there's a lot of very public discussions of very personal things in the form of memoir, TV shows. You know, there's a lot of people are bleeding out. Like, that's my sense, is that everyone is desperately trying to find validation and acceptance from each other. Which, when God dies in a culture, you still need to find some way of dealing with your pain and your suffering. And now we're just doing it with each other. Believing God doesn't negate that. It just changes the way that that looks, I think.
That's really interesting, because one of the priests who inspired me in my youth, he used to talk about how we're all built to worship.
Yes,
we're all built to worship God.
Absolutely.
But if we don't know God and we don't know that, then we have to find something else.
Absolutely.
To fill that void.
Yeah. And I think right now we're worshiping. Well, I mean, look around. Like, what do we worship? Look at the things our culture like places value on, which are things that I place value on. Again, I'm saying all of this as someone who had to go through this myself, worshipping physical beauty, wealth, power, all the things that if you read scripture and other spiritual traditions from around the world, you know, it's not just Christians that have identified that these things are problematic for human beings. You've got to worship something. So the question about how did that happen, on one level, it's a total mystery to me. It's a total mystery. I can give you a kind of a narrative of like a series of events and...
I guess if you went back and you told yourself 12 years ago,
yeah,
when you were an atheist, that in 12 years' time, you will be a practicing Catholic who's been received into the church and now discerning religious life in a monastery, that person would think you're one of those weirdos that you were talking about.
Absolutely. And I just add to that summary, I'm happy as well.
Yeah.
I'm at that. If you said, I don't feel repressed, I don't feel judged. I judge myself an awful lot. And I occasionally hear, I feel like I get far more judgment from my non-Catholic friends sometimes, far more judgment around the decisions I've made than I do from the Catholics that I've met. So I would just add to that I'm happy.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that if you said you were Christian, oh, I'm sorry, I'm really, what happened to you that made you feel that way? You know, there was like a real condescending sort of, you must be really weak, that you need that structure and support. You must be really unhappy that you have to go to church all the time. And again, this really very sort of simplistic, incorrect understanding of what sin, the word sin means, such an infantile understanding of what the word God means. You know, genuinely thinking, dude in the cloud. Like, genuinely thought Christians believed there's a bearded guy in the clouds. No, of course that's... I've never met a Christian that think that. Like, that's an image that sort of...
So how did you go from...
Sorry, I keep going... I just...
How did you go from
just
believing...
Got a lot to say, Julia.
there was a God in the clouds.
What? Okay, what...
To being received into the Catholic Church.
I would say that I opened my mind. I allowed the possibility to enter my mind that possibly, just possibly, I was wrong. That was... So I was 25. I'd moved by this point. I'd moved to Brussels, and I was very, very obsessed with being powerful at that point. I wanted to be like a politician, running stuff, all that kind of... It's just so cringe when I think about it. And I've, you know, there's a lot of beneath that need, there's a lot that I've come to understand that motive was driving me into these worlds. But I was living and working in the European Parliament. I was living a very loud life, I would say. Working in Brussels, or like, well, the best way I can describe it, you're basically students but paid too much money. So we partied a lot, we went traveling a lot, we did all sorts of, you know, just a lot of intense living. And I just snapped. I just completely broke. It was when I was 25. I mean, there's a lot behind that moment, but I broke. One morning I woke up. Well, I hadn't been to bed, actually. That's the truth. I hadn't been to bed, and I was lying on my sofa. Another sofa I had to give up.
She's going to say, it sounds like you had your own cannibal moment.
That's actually when I came to talk to the Jesuits. I think everyone...
I should probably say cannibal moment as in when we're talking about the Jesuits with St. Ignatius.
Yeah.
That he had this moment where a cannonball ends up in his leg and he ends up with a broken leg. And that was the moment he started to discover God and a relationship with God.
Yeah. I actually think everybody has moments like that. I think some can be very dramatic, like a cannonball. But I think every single human being, whether you're Catholic, Christian, atheist, whatever, everyone has a moment of like, oh, I don't know what to do. This is really... And then,
so let's go back to your cannonball.
Yes, my cannonball. I was on my sofa, a sofa that I loved dearly as well. And I had been spent a few months starting to fall apart. There was like, on a very deep level, there was this realization that there was something very wrong. And it was the Saturday morning, and I was lying on my sofa and thinking, I can't do this anymore. Like, I just can't. The way that I'm living my life is not working. It's not working. I actually called my best friend. She's not Christian at all. Spiritual, but, you know, not Christian. And I called her and I said to her, I don't think I can keep doing it. I can't go on. Like, and I don't want to say I was like serious. That word is such a dramatic thing to say. But I knew that I was done. And she hung up the phone on me because I'd been doing this to her for a long, long time.
Okay, so this wasn't like an out of the blue phone call. First time she's heard
she it. She heard it a few times and she hung up the phone. And then she called me back about 10 minutes later. And in those 10 minutes, this is that now I would use the language of grace, and the meaning of that moment has changed over time as I've gone further along this path. But all I can say is in those 10 minutes, I truly knew what hell was. Because if hell is the self-exclusion from God's love, God doesn't send a person to love. You send yourself to hell, right? Again, another misunderstanding. I mean, read the catechism. Love the catechism. Good for this kind of thing. Anyway, so I was in hell for about 5 and 10 minutes. And then she called back, and she herself was in a club in California. And she'd gone out of the club and she'd basically worked out where I needed to go that morning. So she said, Harry, I've booked a taxi to take you to this group that's going to look after you. And I was so broken and so devastated. I said, okay, God gives you options all the time. When you're broken, when you're devastated, when you're lost and confused, the hand is out. Whether you take what's in front of you, that's another question. I wish that God would actually speak to me in words. That's not how God has acted in my life. And I was reading actually something by Basil Hume, who was a Benedictine monk before he became the Archbishop of Westminster. And he said that God speaks to us through the people we meet, through the things that happen to us, through the thoughts that occur to us, through the feelings we have. So everything basically goes. And I was given that opportunity on that day to ask for help. And so I asked for help. And because I asked for help, and this is when I take no credit for where my life has gone. I genuinely, it's kind of hilarious when you think about the idea of taking credit for things, because I didn't choose to be born. I didn't choose to have the brain I have. I didn't choose to have the face I have. I really didn't choose much. Things have come to me. So it's a perception shift that I have to remind myself all the time when I start thinking, oh, you've got such an interesting life, Harry. And like, no. So then I went to this place. I encountered the word God, having just been in hell. And I also saw the word meditation. And I thought, oh, meditation, that's Buddhist. I can do that. I'm going to ignore the God word and I'm going to focus on the meditation, because to me, Buddhism wasn't frightening. Okay. So I decided to open my mind up and to try to understand what was going on. And the word God was suddenly there. And I was very confronted because I'd been very judgmental about this word. But I'd never actually spoken to a Christian. I'd never actually read any book about anything about this stuff. The best phrase I was confronted, one of the many things I was confronted with, was there's no greater barrier to human progress than contempt prior to investigation. And I was contemptuous of all things spiritual, not just Christian, but all things spiritual. But I'd never investigated it, which is the worst place to be, because if you've investigated it and you've concluded, actually, no, it still doesn't make any sense, then great, cool. You've done your work, but you've concluded it's not for you. And that's what I started to do. And that's what I then...
So did you start meditating? Because you said
I did. Yeah.
You had the word meditation and the word God.
Oh, it was so... so intense. I mean, I should have probably seen a psychologist or a psychiatrist, and they would have said, you're having a manic episode. But then you go to see a priest and they'd be like, no, your spirit is coming alive. And actually, the two don't negate each other. Again, there's this idea that science negates religion. No, they're just too acted in my life. And I was reading, actually, it was about 2 or 3 months after this moment. And I was like, I need answers. It didn't occur to me to speak to a priest. I was too frightened of priests. I was too frightened of church. So I went to the Waterstones in Brussels and went to the spirituality section, because I was like, you know, give this a go. And there was the section with all the Bibles and all the Christian stuff, and I was like, nope, absolutely not. So I went to the esoteric section and I got a copy of the Gnostic Gospels.
Okay.
Because one of the things that I decided...
What are the Gnostic Gospels?
Okay, so if you've read the Da Vinci Code,
yes,
that dreadful book, all of the conspiracy theories about like the forbidden gospels and the true secret that the church hid from, you know, all that stuff. I got really into that. So it then became the church wasn't wrong. It was just lying. That was going on. And then there was a Tibetan Buddhist center in Brussels where I went for about 3 months and aggressively meditated for 2 hours a night, every night. It was absolutely horrendous.
I find that really interesting for you to say as someone who's now going to spend a lot of time in prayer.
It's interesting. I mean, I've learned a lot from that experience, and I've read a lot of the Indian scriptures, and I've read a lot about Buddhism and Hinduism. Even those words don't really, you know, they're very westernized understandings of very, very rich spiritual traditions. I was reading a lot of this stuff, a lot of the spiritual stuff, and I then discovered that there was a burst of mysticism in Western Europe in the 13th and 14th centuries. Meister Eckhart, Johannes Tauler, Hildegard of Bingen, Julian of Norwich, all of these medieval mystics.
To tell you a fun fact.
Please tell me a fun fact.
I am actually named after Julian of Norwich.
Are you?
Yeah.
I love that. She's great.
So my parents decided to name me Julia rather than Judy.
Yeah.
And because Julian in the current society is seen as a male name.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm Julia rather than Julian. But
wonderful.
Named after Julian of Norwich.
And she, what was it she said? All shall be well.
Yep.
That's what I wish I'd known. All shall be well. Anyway, so then I started reading all these medieval mystics, and I was like, these are great. Meister Eckhart, especially, if you're into Buddhism, and I had like such a shallow understanding of Buddhism, so I would never claim to know much more than, you know, read a few books. But I was like, wait, why do we need to go to Tibet when it's here? Like, read Meister Eckhart. And I have actually shown Meister Eckhart to a few of my friends who are Buddhists, and they're like, no, this is amazing, this is really, really great. So then I started to soften. I was like, okay, so maybe Christians aren't dumb and emotional and rigid and judgmental. Maybe there's something that I need to look into a bit further. And at this point, I also started to go, there was a church in Saint-Gilles in Brussels, and I would sit at the back. I didn't even know it was a Catholic church, but I would sit there and I'd cry. I cried a lot. For years, I cried.
Crying is a sense of healing.
I would say so, yeah. And I think tears are a grace, actually. I think the ability to cry is not messy. I don't mean like messy crying. I mean, I've been a teacher and seen messy crying from kids, but you know, like tears, there's a grief that's necessary, I think. Anyway, so then I settled down. So bought this library of Catholic mystics, basically, but had no intention of becoming a Catholic. It didn't even occur to me to become a Catholic. Oh, one big thing. I went to an HTB church in Brussels around this time because I was really shopping around. I was like, I'm going to try the Tibetan Center. Like, got some crystals.
What's a HTB church?
Oh, sorry, Holy Trinity Brompton. I didn't understand that it was part of a group, but there was a plant or like a church in Brussels. I met some wonderful people there.
So it's more of an evangelical church.
Evangelical, yeah, absolutely. And I went, I wasn't connecting with what was going on there. It just felt, for me, what did it feel like? A bit overwhelming and a bit too much noise and too much movement and too many smiles. Too many smiles. And this is, I suppose, the point at which this comes up. I went to see the priest and I said, I'm gay and I'm struggling to work out how that works because that was another very messy part of my life. And the priest said to me, that's a really serious sin. You need to stop that now because it's really, really serious. And suffice to say, I ran a mile.
Did he mean you being gay was?
That's well. This is again. This is and you know, I've just mentioned it now. As you know, we talked before recording this, and I was umming and ahhing about whether to actually talk about this because I don't really want to talk about it. But whether I like it or not, it has framed my life and has done. Not so much now, actually.
The conversations we've had, I understand that this is a big part for you, of your decision to become Catholic.
Yeah.
But because we talked earlier in the episode about how there's that kind of view of the church of, and when we come to sexuality, there's a very negative view about in the secular world of how sexuality and the church fit together. So I can imagine for you coming into the Catholic Church, you already had this like negative mindset in that area, knowing that you yourself were gay, but then not knowing how you'd be perceived in the church.
Yeah, I just would say right now, because I know that this is a topic that is detonating the church at the moment, and that's why I want to speak about it, because I don't think it needs to be what it is. I have spent years on that particular part of the catechism where it describes it as disordered intrinsically, whatever the language is. I accept it. Okay, I do not think it should be changed. And if that is upsetting to any people who are gay or same-sex attracted, whatever the language you use to describe it, I apologize for that. But I have concluded, and I would also refer back to the point when I said I'm a happy Catholic. I am happy with the church teaching as it is, and I do not think it should be changed. Now, what I do think needs to change is it needs to be explained. It needs to be taught. I had to work it out for myself. Fast forward to, I had that very unpleasant interaction with the priest in Brussels, and then I ran a mile. 5 years, didn't go. I also shut down a lot of these spiritual practices that I'm going through. I just was like, I needed to settle down. So I then went back into my career. I was working in the parliament when the Brexit referendum happened, and then I was a journalist at Politico for 2 years after. So I just dived into the career. I just put all of this stuff to one side. I remained open, but I wasn't obsessing about it so much. Then I had another breakdown induced by being a journalist. You know, there are certain professions that require you to behave in dubious manners, and political journalism, I caused a lot of trouble, because I'm quite good at people open up to me, which if you're a journalist is great. They tell you secrets that you then publish in stories. So then
people weren't very happy with you after that.
It was horrible. I'd wake up having anxiety attacks every day, and I had the power and I had the fame and I had the politicians being like, please, can we have an interview? I was like, nope, loved it. But also it was a shallow love. It's like a really kind of,
You were basically everything that like the secular world kind of sells you to be, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. Yeah. I was also at this point obsessed with the gym. I still on social media at this point? Ugh, it was just too much. And so I snapped again. And then I decided to become a teacher. So I left Brussels. I committed career suicide, dramatically left Twitter and lost my 20,000 followers. And you know, what a big statement that was. And then went to Norfolk and started training as a teacher. And that was when I was maneuvered by our Lord into a mass. And it was Easter 2019. I was 6 months into the new teaching life, living this very quiet life, somewhat monastic, dare I say, life in Norfolk. Very quiet, very peaceful, lots of green, just around the corner from where Julian of Norwich lived. So I used to walk past her cell on a regular basis. Not that I knew this, but I got 6 months in and I was like, I've made a terrible mistake. Why am I teaching spotty teenagers about the peasants' revolt? Like, this is a nightmare. And so I had one number left. I contacted this guy. He was a lobbyist for a big bank. And I said, hello, just wondering if we could meet up to have a chat about maybe getting back into politics. And he said, oh, funnily enough, I'm in Norfolk. And he said, why didn't you come for dinner with me and my friends? And I thought, oh, I really don't want to go for dinner. I'm quite a solitary person. I went to this dinner and then I was sat next to one of his friends and he said, oh, why don't you come to the Easter Vigil tomorrow night? And I was like, what's a vigil? And he said, it's Holy Week. And I said, what's Holy Week? So just to rewind, like, I had this really weird in-depth knowledge of bits of church history and Christian mystics. I had like really scattered bits of disjointed knowledge, but I'd never connected it with the church that exists today. It had never occurred to me that the church is a living tradition where the mystics are alive and well. The contemplative tradition is still there. It's not currently known in the way that it used to be. And I think that's something that I find exciting, actually, because I think there's a need that's being met that could be met within the church. Anyway, so I go to the mass, not because I wanted to go to mass, but because I wanted to get back into the political game. And I went into the mass.
So you were still kind of being the Harry that you used to be.
Manipulative.
Because you were being, manipulative, but you said it.
Yeah.
You were being manipulative.
Absolutely. I was being incredibly manipulative.
To see what the benefit was for you.
Absolutely.
Not because you were interested in going to the mass.
No, I was like, no, this isn't it. I have an agenda. And this person, if I like make myself, you know, I can play the game. I was playing the game. And so, and it just makes me laugh because A, that's still there. Like, I definitely have that streak in me and I have to keep an eye on it. But also that God would use it. He would use those things about myself that I don't really like, but for a purpose.
That's God created you, right?
Indeed.
He knows how.
Indeed, he does. So get to the mass and I was just blown away. It was just the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen.
You to the mass of the year.
It had to be dramatic. Yeah. It had to be a big deal. When the prologue of John's gospel was read, that was when I realized, oh, this is not frothy. This is not an emotional, silly thing people do because they need support. There's aspects of it, whatever, like that's a whole other conversation. But the prologue, I was like, this is big. This is really big. And so then I leant across and said, I think I want to be a Catholic. Catholic. And I then, a few days later, met the priest for a conversation. And I said to him, this links back to the original questions, like, how did I get from A to B? He said, I think I want to be a Catholic. And I said, there are two problems, Father. I don't think everyone called him Father. I said, I don't believe anything. I don't believe the creed. I'd love to. Sounds great. But I don't believe that God became man. I don't believe in the resurrection, any of that stuff. And I'm gay. And the church hates me. And it's never going to work. And his reaction, God bless the man, he laughed. He smiled and he laughed and he said, right, well, it seems like we have to have a conversation. And over the years, and this that was 4 years ago, over the years, what has happened is I've just come to believe. I now, when I say the creed, there was a particular day last year, actually, when I went, I was praying, I use the creed to pray sometimes. And I went through each line and I said, do I believe? And I said, yeah. And if you were to ask me how that happened, again, mystery on one level, but I have enough evidence in my own life. I've read enough now to understand there's a solid intellectual basis to what the Catholic Church teaches. You know, people have thought about this a lot for thousands of years. Me being a Catholic means that I am connected to a community, if you include the Israelites as well, 4,000 years. 4,000 years.
I'm going to take you back. Sorry.
No. Sorry. I'm going all over the
place.
You
were talking about being at the Easter Vigil and talking to the priest. And I found that really interesting. We've had three conversations with people who've discerned religious life.
Yes.
For this podcast. And all three of them have talked, and I'm sure this is just a coincidence, but have all talked about at some point in Holy Week being really significant
to
them.
How interesting.
So you've gone from talking to this priest about having these two major issues about not wanting to be Catholic.
Yeah.
Kind of have to be sure. How did you get there to being received into the Catholic Church?
So I was a bit surprised because I was, for the first time in my life, ready to sit down and shut up and be taught and do the RCIA. And then I met the priest maybe 6 or 7 times, one-on-one. And then one day he called me and said, right, Feast of St. Augustine. And St. Augustine, I'd read the Confessions way back 10 years ago. And I was like, oh, that's what is going on. Like, sort of very graciously associated my own personal story with that of the great doctor of the church. But then he called me and says, right, let's do it. I don't think he used that language, but he said, would he be willing to be received on the Feast of St. Augustine? And I says, I guess so. But I said to him, I don't know that I believe everything. And what I can now see that he was doing, he could see that the Holy Spirit was in me and acting. And I think there's a big difference between doubting something in order to get away from it and doubting something to get into it. Because actually doubt is why I am where I am. Because the doubt has provoked questions, and the questions have provoked, I've read so many books, and it was quite a solitary process, but I read my way into the church, basically. So that was 2019. And Eve, actually, from the moment I was in that mass, I was like, I need to go further and this is the vocation question about religious life. I think I need to go further with this. And that's been a very difficult thing to unpack and untangle. But I think, you know, if I think about what I've come to understand the Lord's very simple but very challenging command as what do I as a Christian have to do? Love God, love my neighbor. That is the job. That is all our vocation. Every single person's vocation is that. How you live it, that's then the discussion. And then I think the problem that at the moment there's this sense that rather than that being the starting point is right, you've got two options, religious life or married life.
Yeah. Anyone who I've ever talked to about vocation, I talk very much about how sometimes I get frustrated that is presented as the options.
Yeah.
Because I don't even think if you get married, that's your whole vocation.
No.
Because
absolutely.
Like your job is part of your vocation. Yeah. Like what you do at work, and if you're volunteering, that's part of your vocation, what God's calling you to.
And I think if the vocation is to love, the vocation is to love God and love your neighbor, I have found that the best and most effective and most historically consistent way to do that is by being within the Catholic Church. So that doesn't, I went through a phase of being very, very dismissive of other Christians, which actually was fear, my own fear about being wrong. And I judged other Christians a lot. I still believe that the Catholic Church is the church that Christ established. But if someone is baptized in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, they are my brother in Christ. And I would love for them to join me at Mass because it's a beautiful, beautiful experience. But who am I to, especially given my track record, I mean, it's absurd for me to judge another person for going to a different church.
So I have a couple of final important questions to ask you. So the first thing is, what piece of advice would you give to yourself if you could go back to talk to that person 12 years ago who was on the sofa crying to your friend, what piece of advice would you give to them?
I'm immediately thinking of the Julian of Norwich quote, all will be well. All will be well. And all has been well so far. I regularly feel deep anxiety. Regularly. I regularly think, have I just brainwashed myself? Like, is it true? Why am I in a monastery? What am I doing? Huge fear. But then I remind myself of the track record of the last 11 years. All has been well and all will be well. And therefore, there's no need to worry.
It's so true that like all will be well. And it's a really good quote. And I think a really important part of any faith to stand up and say, I believe this. You need to have challenged it and questioned it.
Absolutely.
Talking of questions, my final question for you is, what are you grateful for?
What am I grateful for? It sounds really cheesy. And I think that just reflects how devalued the word has come to be in the culture we live in. I'm very grateful for love in all its forms. The love I've received from my militantly atheist secular friends. The love I've received from the Jesuits who looked after me for the last 3 or 4 years. Particular men who've been so kind, so patient. The love I've received from you, people like you, Julia. You know, I've a wonderful friendship that I didn't see coming over the hill, but here it is. And I'm really, I think that's the key to the whole thing. So God is love. The letter of St. John, John's letter, I think it is, for me, is the paragraph that opened the door to everything. God is love. I see love everywhere. On a bad day, I see sin and evil everywhere. You know, living in London on the tube, commuting to a sixth form where everyone's addicted to their phones, you see darkness, but also you can see love everywhere, everywhere. And that means that if love is everywhere, God is everywhere. And that perception shift is the thing that made all of this possible, all of it. So I would say that would be what I'm most grateful for.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Harry. It's been fascinating to hear some of your story.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Things I Wish I Knew. I know this episode is going to stay with me because of the way that Harry was so open in the conversation and talking about his understanding of his faith and the journey he's been on. So how about you? I'd love to hear about how this story has resonated with you. And why not also tell us if you're facing an experience you wish you knew how to look at differently. It might just be something we can help with. You can write to me at jcorcoran@thinkingfaith.org and find out more about the themes we discussed today at thinkingfaith.org. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me again on Things I Wish I Knew.